Good evening. In Chapter 1 of Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo made a statement that perhaps most probably has never been made before or by anyone else in the history of the world, at least that we know of. Life can become divine. Life will become divine. It is inevitable. And he's very clear about that. He doesn't mean we'll have divine life up in heaven. He means we'll have divine life on earth. And he says, he means by that, that the physical life will be immortal. He's not just saying we'll be happy and things will be pleasant and beautiful. The physical form will be immortal. Pain, suffering, evil, falsehood, ignorance, and all descriptions will be completely wiped out. How is it possible? The very conception of what life is argues against it. Because the common notion in life, in all traditions, in all countries, in all ages is, life means it'll be troublesome, life means difficulty, life means disease, sickness, problems, trouble, suffering. If you have good fortune, you'll also have bad fortune. If you have successes, you have to get failures. It goes together. That's what the dualities are. You can't have one without the other. If you have good people, you also have bad people. And if we are good sometimes, we are also bad sometimes. That all goes without saying. How is a divine life possible? And he tells us something very intriguing there. He says, what we think are contradictions, we think physical life and divine life are contradictions to one another. If we're going to have divine, we have to go to the divine. We have to go to where the things are divine. Here in life, it's impossible. They're opposite. And he says, contradictions are really compliments. We don't know what he means by that. We don't know what he says by that, but it sounds very nice. Oh, contradictions are really compliments. And he says something else. He says, all problems are problems of harmony. But we don't understand what is it we have to harmonize. If we have to get rid of all our problems, what is it we have to harmonize? He doesn't tell us in chapter 1. And then he says, that which is involved must evolve. The divine is involved, it must evolve. And he says the only mistake we shouldn't make is we shouldn't stop in the middle. The more you read in Life Divine, the more you find that everything we come to understand after 10, 20, 30 chapters later, he's already told us in chapter 1 in one sentence. In the 30th chapter, he'll take 30 pages, but he summarized it already in one sentence here. In chapter 2, he raises all the doubts that modern mind, the materialist has, who says divine life is impossible, immortality is impossible, because the only thing that's really real is matter. It's only the material existence. And when we die, it's all over. And the only thing that's really real is the body. So everything else is only an accident. So where's the question of divine life? We're really just physical animals. And in chapter 3, he talks about the sannyasi's view, the denial of the sannyasin, who says, this is a hopeless case. You better move out of here. You better get out of here as soon as possible, because there is no hope in life. There is no salvation in life. In this chapter, we're now on the first chapter, book 2, part 2. We're in the last section. Happens to be almost half the book, but actually out of the 56 chapters, we're now on the 43rd chapter. We're halfway through in pages. We're three quarters of the way through in terms of the chapters. And this is when he begins to unfold fully his vision that justifies everything he has told us up until now. This chapter is reality and integral knowledge. Why does he start this part two with reality and integral knowledge? Because if we go back to the human aspiration, if the human aspiration is possible, if divine life is possible, it must be possible because of the nature of reality. If I say that this seed is going to grow into a mango tree, it must be because this is a mango seed. If this is an apple seed or a plum seed or a grape seed or something else, there's no way it's going to become a mango tree or a mango. So what is the reality on which this universe is based? We have to understand it. And then he says, integral knowledge. If we are seeking integral knowledge, what is it the knowledge of? It's the knowledge of that reality. It's a knowledge that not only is of that reality, it's of the entire reality of which we are a part. So if I have a mango seed and somebody says, this can produce that beautiful fruit, mango, if I don't know the process, what is this tiny little the ugly seed have to do with that, or this tiny little apple seed have to do with millions of apples? I don't understand. And even if I plant that apple seed, it gives a big tree. But what do I do with the tree? I want an apple. The apple or the mango is the divine life. We are talking about a handful of silly seeds. What is the reality? We need a knowledge of that reality. He says we need an integral knowledge. What is an integral knowledge? It must be able to explain to us not only what is the seed, what is the tree, what are the leaves, what are the branches, and what is the fruit. And they all must be part of one reality. Otherwise, there's no way this seed is going to give that fruit. If divine life is the fruit, and a life of ignorance, falsehood, suffering, evil is the seed from which we're starting, we have to understand the relationship between this and that. We have to understand the totality. And that's what he spells out in this chapter. And he starts by saying, let us summarize what we know about the ignorance. Why? Because we want an integral knowledge. And if our goal is an integral knowledge, obviously we have to overcome the ignorance. And the ignorance we have to overcome is a many-sided ignorance. It's not one thing we have to discover that's the secret of everything else, and if you know the secret word, you know the answer to the exam and you get your degree. It's a many-sided ignorance that we need to replace with an integral knowledge. And he summarizes that ignorance. He calls it sevenfold. A sevenfold ignorance. This is a summary of what he told us in the previous 14 chapters, given in a nutshell now. So we can move on to the knowledge. He says the first of those ignorances he calls the practical ignorance. When Bingley asked Darcy to dance with Elizabeth, he says she's tolerable. When Lizzie meets Wickham, she says he's a good man. When Lizzie tells Mr. Bennett, don't send Lydia to Brighton, he says, we'll never have peace and quiet around here if we don't send her to Brighton. In fact, he'll never have peace and quiet again if he sends her to Brighton. This is the practical ignorance. And when you look in the story from beginning almost to the end, all the characters, almost all the time, have a wrong understanding of what's happening, why it's happening, and what's going to happen in future. When he proposes, she says, I'll never, you're the last man on earth I will marry. When he leaves her at Lambton Inn, she says, I'll never see him again. When Collins proposes to her and she refuses, he says, you'll probably never get another proposal. Again, actually within 3 months, she gets a proposal from Darcy. This is the ignorance. And if we look back on our lives, it's very difficult to look back on our life, but it's very easy to look back on other people's lives and see how ignorant they have been. See, first you insisted on doing this and you ran into trouble. And then you insisted on doing that and you ran into trouble. And then you said this was the right thing and you ran into trouble. How you have come out of that trouble, I don't know, but it's certainly not by any virtue of yours. Some luck or grace is there because you're always doing the wrong thing. And that's true. Not of you or somebody else, all of us. Because we are in the ignorance, because our ignorance is practical. We just don't know the right thing or what's going to happen at the next moment. So what do? We go to college, we go to school, we listen to our friends, we read the books, we hope to get the secret of how to get out of this practical ignorance. But he tells us the practical ignorance is the least of our problems. He says, in fact, it doesn't matter how much you study, how intelligent you are, how thoughtful you are. The fact of the matter is you will never get out of the practical ignorance by trying to do the right thing. You will never, because the practical ignorance is not your real problem. You have something called the constitutional ignorance. And the constitutional ignorance is your mind says one thing, your heart says something else, or your vital says something else, and your physical says something else. And they're all the time fighting with each other. And Darcy goes and proposes to her because vitally, emotionally, he wants her. He can't live without her. And when he goes to propose with her, his mind says, I don't know why I'm doing this. This is really the last thing I should be doing. I know I'm spoiling my life by proposing to her. Because there's a conflict between what his mind says, his heart says, and his body wants to do. There's a conflict between what I know I should eat, what I would like to eat, and what my body really needs for its health, and so forth. And he says, unless we correct the constitutional ignorance, we can never come out of the practical ignorance because we're fighting among ourselves. And he tells us that constitutional ignorance will be there as long as we are not aware of that in us, which is really the guide for mind, vital, and body. And he says, but you will never come out of the constitutional ignorance by trying to fight and settle scores between the mind and the vital and the physical. The mind tries to do it. The mind says, look, I'm the boss. I know more than all of you. I'm more intelligent than you. You're vital. You're just following your desires. Physical, you're lazy and unconscious. Listen to me. But if you listen to the mind, we get into so much of trouble. So much of trouble. And he says, so we will not solve the constitutional ignorance unless we come out of the temporal ignorance. The temporal ignorance is, I think my existence began actually about 68 and a half years ago. And for most of us, we think at the time when we die, it's going to end. I'm not aware of how many births I have had in the past. I'm not aware of what the destiny of my births in the future. If you listen to Mother in Agenda, she talks about death as if it doesn't even exist. She talks about a disciple who died and immediately came to her and is keeping company for her after he left the body. He's never leaving her room. He's there. And even when she's having a conversation or somebody's reading to her, that Sadak is listening very carefully to something very interesting to it. Then what is death? Our concept, we don't know. We don't know why we're in this birth. We don't know what's happened before. We don't know what happens after. Without knowing that, you will never understand the significance of what's around us. And he says, you won't come out of the temporal ignorance unless you come out of the psychological ignorance. We're psychologically ignorant. What is that? Psychological ignorance? So I think that me, I, you, is this thing on the surface. I wake up in the morning and I say, now I'm awake. You ask me how I am, I say I'm not feeling good or I'm very happy or whatever it is. The I that we identify with is just this superficial surface, which is a fiction, he says. We don't know the vast subliminal being that we have. We don't know the superconscient being that we have. We are not aware of our subconscient being either. We just live on the surface. We don't know that deep inside there's a psychic being, which is the real, true individual in us. We will never come out of the psychological ignorance, the temporal ignorance, the constitutional ignorance, and the practical ignorance unless we discover our soul. Unless we discover the psychic, which is us. Because the thing that we are trying to act through is not the real center of our being, not the real personality. It's like you go to meet the prime minister and you meet a clerk or a pune in the hall and you start saying, I need this help from you. You must grant us this help and everything. And we're talking to the pune when it's only the prime minister that can give us what we want. We're talking to the wrong person because we don't know who we really are. And he says, but in order to really come out of that psychological ignorance, we have another problem. We have to come out of the egoistic ignorance. The egoistic ignorance is that which tells us that you and I and all of us are separate from one another. And you go your way and I go my way and they're independent of one another. I don't realize, because I'm in the egoistic ignorance, you are all part of me. We are all part of each other. The egoistic ignorance is when I get a mango or when I get a raise or good fortune, I got something. When you get it, you got something. Even if I understand it, my heart doesn't see your getting something and my getting something is the same. We are part of the same being. We are a universal being, not a separate being sitting here all separate from one another, living all our own lives, self-centered, selfishly organized lives. We cannot come out of our problems as long as we're in the egoistic ignorance. That's what Darcy realizes. All this time he's trying to get rid of Wickham. He's trying to pay him off and get rid of him, try to protect himself from Wickham. He finally comes to the conclusion, unless I get Wickham married, unless I pay off his debts, unless I make him respectable also, in spite of all he's done for me, I'll have no peace and quiet. Somehow that man is part of my life. I tried to get rid of him. I can't get rid of him. He's like the shadow. I can run as fast as I want from my shadow. It will still be there wherever I reach. So I have to accept him as part of my life. I have to come out of the egoistic ignorance. Well, when we've done all of that, Sri Aurobindo will say, we're still very ignorant. Because we're still in the universe, we're still in the world. We may no longer be thinking our ego and our surface mind and life and body are the problem. But we don't know, what about the divine? What about beyond the universe? Who created the universe? If life is to become divine, there must be something that we don't find in life that's going to come in life. We are in the cosmic ignorance. The cosmic ignorance is we think the cosmos is everything. We think the world is everything. We don't know the world is a tiny little place. For the divine consciousness, the world is a tiny little place. It exists way far beyond the world. It exists beyond all worlds. And we don't know how many there are. And that is our true being. We have to discover our silent self, the immortal, infinite self that's not part of this world, not limited to this body, not limited to this personality, not even limited to this psychic being, because we're part of something infinite and eternal, a self, the divine being. We are that. And he says, once we know that, once we know that being that has become this universe, we still don't know the final truth, because that being itself is only an expression or a shadow of the real reality which we call Brahman or the Absolute, which we can't even say it's a divine being. We can't even say it's an infinite or eternal self. It's something beyond all of these things, and it is the truth of our being. So that's the original ignorance from which all our problems start, because we don't know the origin of everything. So when somebody comes and tells us, or read Sri Aurobindo saying that life can become divine. How can life become divine? It's dirty, it's noisy, it's full of all types of problems and filth and all types of horrible things. How can it become divine? Because unless we know what is the origin of life, what is the origin of the world, what is the origin of our being, what is the truth of our being, this doesn't make sense. It sounds very nice. We would like to believe it. Yes, yes, it's going to become divine and everything's going to be wonderful, happily ever after. But is it really possible? Is it really true? Unless we have the integral knowledge of reality, it will only be an idea for us, or at best a faith for us. So this chapter has come to tell us what is reality. What is the real, real reality? And when we talk on an integral knowledge, how can we fully know that reality? Because when we fully know that reality, we will come to the conclusion he came in the first chapter, that divine life is not only possible, it's absolutely inevitable. This is a mango seed. You plant it, you water it, and be patient. Mango fruit is coming. It's as simple as that. There's no doubt. You're not going to get apple or pear or plum or anything else. You're going to get mango. Guaranteed. It's not magic. It's fact. So we must know what that reality is. So then it raises the question, okay, there is a reality. What is integral knowledge? Integral knowledge is based on the idea that reality is integral. He told us in the first chapter, don't make the mistake that everybody makes, that everybody up until now has made. He doesn't say that. Only later we understand. Every tradition, every great tradition, Buddha, Shankara, all of them, have all discovered great truths. We are not here to criticize Shankara or Buddha or Christ or Muhammad or Moses or anybody else and say these were foolish, ignorant people. They didn't know of common sense. They all discovered great truths, real truths of reality, real truths of the divine. But they all made the same mistake. They stopped in the middle. Somebody got a leaf of the mango tree and thought, this is the mango. Somebody got a branch and thought, this is the mango. We get parts. They get a glimpse. They got the skin of the mango or the root or something. We want the whole truth, the whole reality. So we need to have an integral knowledge that tells us the whole thing. And he says, an integral knowledge is possible because the integral reality already exists. We are not going to create it. The reality that is the ultimate reality already exists. In fact, it's the source of everything. It's our source. It's the source of our own being. It's not something like the mango that has to grow out of the tree. It already is here. But we have to give up the ignorance, come out of the ignorance, and come into the knowledge to know the truth of our own being, to know the truth of the world, to know the truth of the transcendent, which we call divine, to know the truth of the absolute, because that's our truth. That's the truth of us even now. Divine life may take some time. Supermentalizing may take some time. But the truth of what, of the integral truth of reality is the truth of us even now. Only now it's in the form of a seed, and we want the fruit. We want the fruit. In order to have that integral knowledge, we need an integral consciousness. We need a consciousness that doesn't just see the parts. It's not enough that I hear things, or that I see things, or that I touch things, or I taste things. Physically, we have five senses. The blind man may have a very good sense of hearing, but he misses what you can see. The deaf person may have a very keen sense of sight, but he misses the sound. We need an integral consciousness that's capable of seeing the reality in its totality. That consciousness, what does it mean that it's integral? It must be able to be aware of the truth of the individual, the truth of the world, the cosmos, the universal, and the truth of the transcendent divine. It must be conscious of all three of them simultaneously as aspects of one truth. Because remember, reality, this basic premise of all tradition is the truth is one. The truth is not world. The truth is not just God. The truth is not just the individual. There's one truth of which these are all expressions. We need a consciousness that's capable of seeing that the mango seed, the mango tree, and the mango fruit are different expressions of one reality. The reality is not the fruit or the seed or the tree. It's something that includes all of them. We need a consciousness that can be aware of all of them. We need a consciousness that can not only discover the spirit in trance, like great yogis, we must be able to discover the spirit in matter. We must be able to know the spirit in life, the spirit in mind. We must have an integral consciousness that can discover the spirit everywhere, because there's only one existence expressing, whether it expresses as mind, life, body, or pure spirit. So we need a consciousness that includes all of these in order to have an integral knowledge to know the integral reality. So what is this thing, this ultimate thing that he calls the absolute? Let's forget all these six other stages of ignorance. We want to go to the heart of things. We want to go to the heart of the reality. And the heart of reality we'll only know when we reach the last ignorance, the original ignorance, and we'll discover what is called the absolute. And according to what we discover, when we get through all those rooms of ignorance, we come out into knowledge at each level, when we finally reach the last chamber and we discover the ultimate reality, we'll come out of the original ignorance into the ultimate knowledge, which is known in the tradition as the absolute. In Western, they call it absolute. In Indian tradition, they call it the Brahman. So what is that? Everything's going to depend on what we find out when we reach the last chamber. And there are different views on what that absolute is. And what is the relationship between that absolute and the world? The view of Shankara was that the absolute is real, is the only reality, is the one eternal, infinite reality, and the universe has no reality. At best, it's a fiction of Maya or a temporary thing. So if the nature of the absolute is some infinite being, formless being, eternal being, that's there in some absolute silent trance of bliss, where's the question of divine life? Where is the question of a divine life? If that's the reality, then the only thing that makes sense for us is to quickly shed our body, not worry about educating our minds, not worry about cleaning our houses, not worry about flowers and cars and education and marriages and everything. Let's get out of this because this is a hopeless case. Nothing here. We have to go there. We have to go to that nameless, formless, unknowable, inexpressible vacancy, which is very blissful. Because that's the reality, and this is all an illusion. If Buddha is right, we have a slightly different destination. Because he says that ultimate reality is not even a being of bliss. It's an emptiness. When we finally climb to the last chamber and we come into the last chamber for the ultimate reality, we find there's nobody home. Nobody lives there. But it's very peaceful. And it's very sweet. And after all of this suffering on earth and climbing through all of these chambers and working so hard to get to the ultimate reality, time for rest. Oh, this is nice and quiet. No problem. Nobody can disturb me here. There's nobody. There's nothing. There's not even a divine being. Divine being is only an illusion that I had. I thought there was a divine waiting there. My heart was longing to get there. When I find out there's nothing, it's just emptiness. But it's very peaceful and very happy. Very, very happy. No disturbance like Mr. Bennett in his library forever and ever. And nobody can disturb him ever again. If that's the nature of the absolute, then where's the question of divine life? And Buddha says this is a hopeless case, this is a hopeless wheel of suffering and everything. Don't waste your time thinking of divine life here. Don't even think that God is waiting for you up there. What's waiting for you up there is an empty library where you'll never be bothered again. So if this view of reality is correct, then divine life is not possible. And notice, Shankara talks about Brahman. Buddha talks about absolute. So we use the same word, but their conception of Brahman or absolute or ultimate reality has no relationship with life, no relationship with earth, no relationship with us. Buddha says you have to get rid of the ego and there's nothing left. Shankara says even the soul is temporary. And when you get to Brahman, the soul disappears, it dissolves. So where's the question of you having the divine life and living forever? The soul won't, let alone the body, even the soul won't exist. The soul will just go back into the divine being and dissolve. So where's the question of a divine life? So if this conception of the ultimate reality is true, this divine life thing is just an illusion. We're wasting our time and no sense thinking about it. So he has to tell us that this conception of reality is not the ultimate conception. Not the ultimate conception. It's not the ultimate reality. Each of them have discovered some truth, but not the real truth, not the integral reality. And if you only when you have discovered the integral reality, you will have the integral knowledge of an integral spiritual consciousness, and then you will know, then alone you will know, life divine is inevitable. Here's the seed, there's the mango, it's only a question of a process, we're going from here to there. Otherwise it doesn't make sense. And that's what he's telling us in this chapter. Why is it so difficult to know what this absolute reality is? Because we're seeking to know the absolute reality using the instrument of our mind. And he's already spent 14 chapters telling us that the mind is the source of all our problems, not our solutions. The mind is the thing that's created the ignorance. The mind is the thing that's put us into the cosmic ignorance, the constitutional ignorance, the temporal ignorance, the psychological ignorance, the original ignorance, and the practical ignorance. You can't use that instrument to try to get to the integral knowledge. The problem for mind is, whatever we experience at the moment, we take it to be the whole thing. Shankara had many, many great yogis that had marvelous experiences. We can marvel at them. We can be envious of them that we don't have such great spiritual experience. But he says all of those experiences were experiences in the mind. So when the greatest sages had the experience of the eternal self, when they went and had the experience in trance of an eternal infinite self, it was a mental experience. And when the mind touches the reality of the self, the world disappears. It simply disappears because mind is not capable of seeing the totality. It can see one thing at a time. It can concentrate on one thing at a time. When we're talking about life divine, I can't be thinking about my health or breakfast tomorrow morning or solving the problems of the world or who's going to win the next election. It takes all our energy just to focus on what he's saying in one chapter or one sentence. Sometimes by the time you get to the end of the sentence, I forget what was there at the beginning of the sentence. It takes so much of concentration. That's the mind. So the yogi who concentrates to get and find out the real reality, by the time he uses his mind to do it, by the time he contacts that reality, he's forgotten everything else, lost touch with everything else. He assumes that nothing else exists. When you're in the trance, when you have the experience of the cosmic self or a transcendent being, you're lost in it. Nothing else seems to be real, because that's the nature of mind. So the yogis made the mistake of thinking, if that's what happens to me when I go to the trance, when I go into the trance, the world ceases to exist. Then that means that the world doesn't exist in that place. We assume that the divine has the same problem we have, or the divine is also a mind, and so when it is experiencing that bliss, the world doesn't exist for it. It never occurs to us that the divine may have capacities we don't have. It never occurs to us the divine may be capable of feeling the bliss of infinite oneness and at the same time becoming a universe and experiencing everything around us. We impose our limitation on the divine and we say that's the reality. Which makes no sense. Because if that's the reality, then the divine, how does the divine and the world exist together at the same time? If we go there and we find the divine, and then we come back here and we find the divine, does it mean the divine became that and then came back here, and it's only in, can only be in one place at one time the way we are? Common sense is that state of absolute oneness exists and this state of the many exists simultaneously. They're two sides of the same reality and the divine includes both of them. We are feeling finite and limited. And if we have the divine, the spiritual experience, we suddenly realize behind that limitation, that finite, there's an infinite. The infinite doesn't disappear when the finite appears. The infinite is there all the time behind the finite. Rather, the infinite expresses as the finite. But to mind, it's either one or the other. And we impose that limitation. So this is one of the reasons why in all the traditions, they have failed to understand the real nature of reality, which is what he is explaining to us here. So what is Sri Aurobindo's view? He's told us already. And he says there's a confirmation of this in the Upanishads, in the Vedanta, especially in the Isha Upanishad. He says not only that there is only one, Brahman is the sole existence. At the same time, it tells us all is Brahman. Not only is there only one reality, which is Brahman, but that reality includes everything. All is Brahman. That reality not only includes the transcendent one, that reality includes the cosmic multitude, that reality includes the individual. And none of the traditions have recognized something very important for us, personal message to us, Sri Aurobindo's delivered, because divine life is not a divine life for the universe. Say, practically speaking, if the scientist says that the universe is going to exist forever, first thing I would ask is, what is it to me? What do I care whether the universe is going to exist forever if I'm only going to be here for a few more decades? But Sri Aurobindo is saying not the universe will exist forever. You, as an individual, not as this body, not as Gary, not in this, when you become the supramental being, you as an individual are immortal. Not just the world, not just the divine. If the divine is immortal, it's very nice, but what does that have to do with us? You are immortal. The individuality in you is immortal. And it can be immortal there, up above in the spirit. It can be immortal here, in the body. So he affirms the truth. The integral reality is that not only is the divine being or the transcendent, unmanifest one true, but the cosmos is immortal and the individual is immortal because they're not three separate things. It's not like we've got one divine up there, we've got one world, and we've got lots of individuals. We are all expressions of something beyond that. It is the absolute. The reality has become three. Not three separate things, not three different pieces. That this reality expresses itself, manifests itself, and is enjoying itself by simultaneously expressing in three different ways. As a transcendent one beyond the manifestation, creating the manifestation and looking down on it, as the infinite universe, and as a multitude, an infinite number of individual souls, all of which are, at the same time we're individual, we are all one. At the same time we are connected with each other, we are actually all one. Hard to conceive, hard to express. Jane Austen writes a story. She creates a world called Pride and Prejudice, filled with characters. But all those characters are really expressions of her personality. They all live in her consciousness. They're all part of her. They're all connected with each other. The world she's created, which we call Pride and, the story of Pride and Prejudice, is part of her consciousness. And she's there, the creator of it. Why? For the joy of expressing this story and living through these characters and living through these events and enjoying them, but never limited by them. And she's not limited by one story. She can have 2 stories, 10 stories, 1,000,000 stories. She can live all of them successively or simultaneously, because the reality of what she is beyond any story or all stories, beyond any character or all characters, but they all are aspects of her. And the reality, we can't say the reality is Jane Austen, the author, alone. But what about her stories? Her stories are part of her. In fact, we know more of Jane Austen through her stories than we do about her life. If you read her letters and all, her life was not on the surface. She did not lead a very glorious life. The truth of Jane Austen includes her stories and includes all the characters in her stories as well. It's an integral knowledge we need. If we really want to know Jane Austen, we must know Jane Austen, the author, Jane Austen through her stories, and each of the characters she's created, which is expressing something of her infinite creative potential. And that would be an integral knowledge of Jane Austen. And what we want is an integral knowledge of the absolute, of the reality of everything from which we come. Because as all the stories and characters come from Jane Austen, we are all expressions of a one. And I have said in earlier meetings, imagine trying to convince Darcy that he's only a character in a story written by some lady 200 years ago who never got married and was the daughter of a clergyman and all, of course, it won't make any sense to him. He feels he's a separate being. He lives in Pemberley. He's married to Elizabeth, and that's it. He doesn't realize the larger existence of which he's a part, which is the truth of his existence. And that's our position as well. That's our ignorance. We don't realize. We are not just, the difference is, if Darcy says, you mean to say I'm only a character in somebody's story? That doesn't sound very good. I thought I am the master of Pemberley. I have a lot of respect in everything. Now you're telling me I'm only a character in somebody's story written 200 years ago? No. The truth is, Darcy, you are the one who wrote that story 200 years ago. You, The truth of your being is you are not the invention of Jane Austen. You are Jane Austen. Jane Austen is the truth of your being. And when you know that the truth of your being is Jane Austen, you can create any number of stories you want. You can be anything you want. You're not limited to being this kind of selfish, aloof person who doesn't know how to deal with other people and is longing for Elizabeth. You can be anything you want to be because you are the author of the whole universe and all the universes, and that's the truth. We are not a small, what do you call it, bit part, they say in the movie. No, he had a bit part. Somebody was the doorman at the hotel, and when the hero ran in the door, the doorman opened the door, or somebody was driving the car when the hero was chasing the criminal or whatever it is, the driver or the doorman or whatever it is. We are not the bit part. We are the creator of everything. We are one with the reality that has become the universe. We are one with that divine. And only when we know that that is the reality, only when we have that integral knowledge of the truth of our being, then we will understand that's why your life can become divine. That's why you can become immortal. Yes, you're a mango seed. You'll become a mango. It's inevitable. Because you are the divine one that becomes everything. Only thing is, our tree, our seed is not a mango seed. Our seed is a seed that can become anything you want to become. Or everything you can ever want to become. Because that is the divine. That is what the divine has created, a universe. It has become a universe. It contains all the seeds. Actually, it's very good that you say that, because he tells us that. Rather, he tells us that lead can be, he says, pearl can become diamond. Do you remember? We read it. He told us. When you really have the knowledge of the essence, which is the absolute, not only can you make a pearl or make a diamond, you can convert a pearl into a diamond. He says it. You can have both. You can have them all. Because that which becomes everything is the same. We think that once something's become a diamond, say actually, you know, if any scientists in the room, you know, a diamond is only, carbon. It's only a chain of carbon atoms. And pearl is also a chain of carbon atoms. And they're all made up of the same atoms. We know that. That's why they can make artificial pearls and artificial diamonds. So if you can make a diamond, or you can make a plastic, or you can make a pearl, or so many other things as well, why can't you convert one into another? We don't know how to do that yet, because we are only manipulating them. But when you are that thing that has become the pearl, you have decided to become a pearl, you have decided to become a diamond, if you change, you can decide to convert from a pearl to a diamond, and that's the divine life. Mother says you can have any form you want. You can be anything you want. Even in the Gita, he said, you can become anything you believe you can become. Mother would say, you can become anything you will to become, because that's what the divine has become. The divine has become you and us. And hopefully it wasn't by mistake. Hopefully we are here because we want, the divine wanted to be us. The divine wanted to be us, not so we should stop in the middle and be very proud of what we are. The divine wanted to be us because we don't know where we're going yet. We're still the seed. We haven't seen the fruit yet. The divine, each of us, each soul, is a seed of the divine consciousness which is intended to sprout and flower into a different flower and a different fruit, all of which are divine, all of which are very tasty, sweet, and beautiful to see and smell. And that's why the divine has become so many souls. Divine didn't create so many souls, it became. It is so many souls. It is even now all of us. It is deciding and willing to become many different things. All the flowers in the universe, all the colors in the rainbow, and all the beautiful forms of delight of which it can conceive, it is becoming through an evolutionary process. And therefore, when he says we can be diamond or we can be pearl, because in essence we are already that, but this is a process of unfolding. We're still in the seed stage. We want to get to the flower and the fruit stage, which is the what he calls the divine life. The key to understand that is we have to know what we are. We have to know what this seed is. This is an infinite seed. It's an infinite seed that contains everything. And it's an infinite seed that's not limited to everything. It's beyond everything. It can become anything it wants, and it still is not limited to everything. It's beyond all of that. It's unknowable. It's infinite, eternal, and unknowable, but it contains everything. There's nothing outside of it. This is an integral view of reality. This is his view. The mind makes many types of error. It mistakes and says he sees only the finite, and it denies the existence of the infinite. It sees only the many and denies the existence of the one. It sees only the world and denies there can be anything beyond the world. Or it goes into trance and it sees the unmanifest infinite one and decides that all of this was only a bad dream and doesn't exist anymore because we see a part and mistake it for the whole. So that's what he means. Remember in chapter 1, I said that contradictions are complements. He told us, page 2 at the top, contradictions are complements and all problems are problems of harmony. What did he mean? He meant somebody sees the finite and somebody sees the infinite. They're contradictions. Make up your mind. Either things are finite or they're infinite. There's either one or there's many. There's either the forms of the universe or there's a formlessness. Which is the truth is what the materialist says. Only the forms are true. Only the many are true. The sannyasi says only the infinite formless one is true. He says these apparent contradictions are really complements. They're two sides of the same reality. Mother says it over and over in Agenda. When you look at one side of the hand, you see the falsehood and the ignorance. When you turn it on the other side, you see the truth. It's not a different hand. Depending on how you look at it, you see this side or that side. You can see the finite side or the infinite side, the one or the many, the form or the formless. But it's only one reality. So contradictions are complements. And how do they harmonize them? When we get to the real reality, the absolute integral reality, we no longer have this problem. You can be this, you can be a pearl, or you can be a diamond. You can be a mango, or you can be an apple. You have to make up your mind. Because they're not two different things. They're two different expressions of one reality. So, fundamentally, he rejects the idea of either or. There is no either or. There's nothing you can be that or you can be this. or the divine is this, but the divine is that. The divine is all and more than all, and capable of expressing in any way it wants. And that's how he reconciles the one and the many, the finite and the infinite, the form and the formless. In the story, we see Darcy and Wickham. In many ways, they're opposites. Wickham is very handsome, very charming, very sweet on the surface, but completely rotten inside. Darcy's rough and crude and offensive on the surface, but he's good as gold inside. We see it. Well, I like Darcy. I don't like this Wickham. Or like Lizzie, she says, I like, or Lydia. Lydia says, I like this Wickham very much. I don't care about this Darcy. He's a nasty man. What is the reality? The reality is that Darcy and Wickham are two aspects of a greater reality. They are not contradictions. They seem to be contradictions to each other. They are each partial expressions of a greater truth, and when they fully discover their truth, they'll realize they're complements to one another. They are complements to another because each of them is there to help bring out the truth in the other. Wickham is a standing example to Darcy of what a sweet, charming, pleasant man can be, which Darcy never learned. Darcy is a standing example to Wickham of what real truthfulness and goodness are. So the reality is not Darcy is good, Wickham is bad, or one way or the other. The reality is something greater, and these two exist together in contrast to each other so that through their interaction, a greater truth can manifest in each of them. So we think of the reality, well, what's my truth? I think of my truth as if it's something separate from all of you. But all of you are part of my truth. All of you represent parts of the truth that I haven't discovered yet or I haven't manifested yet. By interacting with the whole world around me, I come to a truth. The truth of Darcy's soul is not the Darcy we know at Pemberley. The truth of Wickham's soul is not the Wickham we know at the Meryton. Truth is there still in the seed stage, and they're going to evolve to a spiritual stage where we see the flower, the spiritual flower of their being, and they're both divine. They're both divine in essence. They're both in transition, and the meeting and interaction with each other is the process, like the rain and the digging up and the weeding and everything, to help bring out what's hidden in between. Our preference is we choose. Don't marry Wickham. He's a scoundrel. Marry Darcy and the whole thing is over for us. We've settled. The story's at the end. But without Wickham, I think you know it. You've seen it. We've discussed it. Without Wickham, Darcy doesn't make this progress. And without Darcy, Wickham won't make the progress. We need each other. We need not only each other as people. We need every challenge that comes to us, every difficulty that comes to us, every example we have, whether it's good example, an inspiring example on one side, or somebody doing something we think is very bad for us. Every experience that comes to us, positive or negative, is there to help us come from the seed to the flower or the fruit, because we are not the end product. We're still the seed. No sense claiming credit and wanting to go to a flower show and win the award. We're still seeds. They don't give awards for seeds. They only give awards for the flowers. We have to go through that process, grow, flower, and then we will know what we really are. If you have so many beautiful flowers in the meditation, the birthday room now. If you show them in the seed stage, we won't be able to know. Is it a red rose or a pink rose or a white rose or a... You won't know the difference. Only when it flowers, you will know what really it's intended to become. Look at Jane and Lydia. Oh, this Lydia is an abomination. Get rid of her. How she ever came into that family, I don't know. Jane is a sweet girl. But the progress of the family, all the energy is with Lydia. All the courage is with Lydia. The individuality is with Lydia. Jane is just trying to be polite and so nobody should criticize me and nobody should find fault with me. She has that sweetness. She has that goodness. She never thinks of another person. She's not thinking how I can help Lizzie get married. Lizzie is thinking how Jane can get married. So Jane and Lydia, Jane and Lizzie are apparently opposites to each other in different respects. And through their interaction with each other, each of them will manifest something. The way we look with the mind, we say, no, Lydia is very low, get rid of her. Mary is useless. Kitty's childish. Jane is okay, pretty good. She's got a lot done, but Lizzie is the real thing. It's not like that. They're all seeds, and they need each other. And the interaction with each other is we're all divine, and what's going to emerge is divine. And we are not in a contest and a race to see who's going to win the flower contest. Because there's only one in this contest. The judge and all the flowers and everything is only one. It's the divine. Let me see how many different types of flowers I can become. And I can enjoy being all of the different types. It's not like you will get the award and I'll miss the award. We will all enjoy the award of all. The joy of every manifestation. Right now we see we're all suffering in relation to each other. I'm jealous of what that person gets. This person is abusing me and jealous of me and giving me troubles. And it's a contest everywhere. I don't realize there's no contest. There's only one. This is our story. There's only one story. And we're all winning. We're all coming to the end, to the same joy and delight. And we need each other to get us there, because as seeds, we'll never get there. We need to grow from the seed. We need a little stimulation. We need a little lessons. We need an education. We need to be awakened and the truth of our being that should come out. We sit there in the ego proudly saying, you see, I'm better than that person. I'm more organized than this person. I'm more clean than that person. I read more and I know more of life divine than that person. I meditate for longer than this other person is. I'm more popular than the other person. Everybody around us, we're comparing and contrasting the contradictions, not realizing they're all us. They're all here to help us. It's very nice if everybody's going to help me, but I must also understand I'm here to help everybody else also. This is the egoistic ignorance. When we come out of that, we find out the formula, which is so simple. It's so simple, it's so childish that you mean you have to write 1,072 pages in order to do this? The whole truth of the matter is self-giving. The constitution of the human being is made in one direction. What can I get from everything and everybody around me? Because ego, it's important. I have to build up my ego. I have to get a better job. I have to get a better marriage. I have to get a better education. I have to earn money. I have to get car. I have to get house. I have to get this, that, popularity, everything else. Appa should write something to me. Mother should bless me. I should have good, my prayer should be answered. My consecration, I should be able to remember mother on the hour because it's all for this seed. But the truth is, we're all in this together. And we're all here to, we grow and succeed and flower together. If one gets water, we all get the water. If it doesn't, if it rains for one, it rains for all. We are here, we grow most, not by what we get from others. We grow most by what we give to others. It's such a simple formula. It's so easy to speak. It's so hard to remember for more than 1 minute at a time. So the integral knowledge is not just a knowledge of the one. It's a knowledge of the many. It's not just a knowledge of the infinite. It's a knowledge of the finite. It's not the kind of knowledge that you get in the school or in the books or in Wikipedia or on the internet or listening to your mother on how to cook or the doctor or anything else. It's not, I must know the one and I must know all the many. We must know the one in the many. We must know the many as the one. The knowledge we need is to know the one in ourselves and the one in each other person. It's not I must know the divine and I must know all of you. I must know the divine in all of you and in myself and beyond all of us. That is the integral knowledge. It's not either this or that. The scientist says knowledge is knowledge of the many. Knowledge is knowledge of physiology and anatomy and pharmacology and genetics and economics and history and so many things which we're foolishly ruining the minds of our children by making them study. The yogi says knowledge is to know the one. Sri Aurobindo says neither is the knowledge, or rather both. That is a knowledge, but it's a partial knowledge. This is a knowledge of the form. It's like the banana skin. What's the idea of having the banana skin? You want the fruit inside. The fruit inside is the divine in each person, in each thing. We need to know both sides. We need to see them, both sides of one thing, the same hand. We need to see all the many are expressions of the one. We need to see Mother coming to us through everybody, including and especially those who are giving us a lot of trouble. That's integral knowledge. She's inside each of us. She wants to come out. She wants to manifest. And that's why we know her. That's why even on the surface we know that Mother exists, that this knowledge is there. She's there in each of us, trying to come out. When one becomes the many, it doesn't cease to be one. When the gold is made into a vase, a vessel, a spoon, a jewel, it doesn't cease to be gold. It remains the gold, whatever the forms is in. The divine has become all of these forms, even in great disguise, painted black on the outside or put very dirty or whatever it is, but it's still the gold. The essence is the gold, and all we need to bring out that essence and make it apparent on the surface. A lot of this chapter is focusing on ultimately what is real. And he talked to us in chapter 2 about the materialist view that only the objective reality is fundamentally real. If I have a disease, I pray to Mother, Mother can help me. I think the disease is real. Mother is somehow not very tangible to me, but somehow she can act on a physical disease. I don't realize there is, if the disease, if my body is the object, there is no object independent of the consciousness. Rather, it is the consciousness that's expressing as a disease in the body. If I change the consciousness, the form, the object, changes. They are two sides of the same reality. How can an intangible, invisible divine change something that's physical is the objective view, because it says the object alone is real. He says the object is one side of the reality, the object is a form of spirit. When that the consciousness of the spirit changes, the form will change. A disease can disappear. You know the story of Moritz Goodman? He broke almost every bone in the body. The doctors gave him 3-4 days to live, even that only on artificial respiration and artificial heart stimulation. He can't speak. He can't do anything. And he signals with his eyes that within 12 months I'm going to walk out of here. And he did. Whatever he understood with his mind or not, his soul understood this body, this form, is only an expression of the consciousness. And if the consciousness wills to walk out of here, I can walk out of here. And he did. This was a physical fact. Physically measured. All these bones are broken. Nobody has ever survived an accident of this magnitude with so many bones broken. And everything is broken. Everything is over. But the reality is the consciousness, the faith he had in the power of consciousness. And then that other story I've mentioned to you about Mr. Wright, who had the big tumor in his stomach, this big tumor. You remember the story? This is a true story. It was published in the U.S. papers about 1960. Documented story. This Mr. Wright had a big tumor this size in his abdomen. At that time, they had no chemotherapy and all treatment or all of this. Doctors said there's no hope. Mr. Wright said, I have been reading some journals and everything, and they say that there's some serum that they have used and cured. They developed it for horses, and some people have also tried it, and it cured cancer. So will you give it to me? Just out of sympathy with the patient, after all, he's got a week or two to live. Why deny him anything he wants? Worst it can do is kill him, which he's already going to die. So the doctor said, all right, and he went and got some of this serum. I forget the name, but it's a chemical, and gave it to him. 3 days later, the tumor was gone, completely gone. They did the x-rays, all the studies and everything. It's just completely disappeared. Doctor was bewildered beyond measure. What is this miracle? Medicine here that has just dissolved this tumor in 3 days. It's an absolute miracle. He was in perfect health, feeling fine. They discharged him from the hospital. Of course, they tested everything and documented the whole thing, and the case was written up in medical journals. It's a standing miracle. They have discovered a cure for cancer. 1 month later, he came back to the hospital complaining of intense pain, and then they did the x-rays again, and the tumor is dead. It was gone. It's physically gone, and now suddenly it's back again. doctor was totally confused. He said, what happened? What happened to you? What happened in the last 1 month? I don't understand it. I don't know how it disappeared, but how did it come back? If it was a miracle that it disappeared, it's equally a mystery that it could come back. And he said, oh, after I went home, I started reading a lot about this serum, and I found out that actually these cases, it was misreporting. It doesn't really work with human beings. When he realized it doesn't work with human beings, the whole tumor came back. Then the doctor began to wonder. Oh, it's not the serum that has cured this man, it's his own mind. So he told the man a story. He went away and came back a few days later and he said, I have been doing further research. What you said about that horse serum was correct. It doesn't work, it only works with horses. But they've developed a super variety of that serum now, which is fully successful, 100% successful with human beings. So if you want, I will give it to you. Yes, yes, give it to me. He gave him some watery syrup or something like that. Nothing. It was nothing at all. The whole tumor disappeared again. They studied the man carefully, very carefully, documented everything, took pictures and all, tests and everything. Because nobody will believe this story if you tell them later. So they wanted to, the doctor didn't want people to laugh at him if he talks about this later. So he's documented it, shown the other doctors, made them all see the reality of it and all agree, yes, yes, he's really cured, sent him home. 2 months later, he came back with the tumor again. Doctor said, what happened? Oh, doctor, I read about this super serum and everything, and finally it turns out none of these things work. He died a week later. So which is which? Is it the objective truth of the tumor that's real, or is it the subjective power of the consciousness that's real? How do you resolve this? There are whole philosophies that say the whole universe is only an expression of our consciousness. That's what Maya is. That's what Shankara said. You think the world is real. World is simply what Maya has imagined it to be. And when Maya reads and discovers that there's no super serum, the world disappears. That's when you go and have moksha. When you have moksha, you realize the world was an illusion and it disappears. It's all an expression of the world is not fundamentally real, according to that view. The scientist takes the opposite view. Whatever you think or not, there's a tumor here. And all this story about Mr. Bright is a hoax. Don't believe it. No tumor ever disappeared because somebody thought that it could disappear. This Morris Goodman and all, I don't believe it. It's all stories and propaganda. And some, so he could walk out of the hospital and become a famous man giving lectures on how he cured himself and earning a living. It's all a hoax. I don't believe a word of it. Even if there's evidence, even if you can see the x-rays, it's all I don't believe it. They have tricked us. So there are these two views. Sri Aurobindo says the objective is true, the subjective is true because they are both expressions of the same reality. Spirit has become matter. The material universe is real. It's spirit. It's Satchitananda. The spirit is real. They're two expressions of the same reality. If the spirit can become matter, then matter can become spirit. If Mr. Wright's belief can become a tumor, then it can also stop being a tumor. The world has been created. The world is not an imagination of Maya. The world is a real manifestation of the divine consciousness. Now in the ignorance, looking more like a tumor than anything else. And when the consciousness decides that this will be divine life, when the divine consciousness within the world wakes up, that is in us, when Mother emerges in each of us, instead of being a tumor or a seed or anything else, we will be realize ourselves as flowers and expressions of the divine consciousness, and every moment will be a moment of divine bliss and fulfillment and beauty. That is the divine life. So it's not a question, this is unreal and that's real, or that's real and this is unreal. They are two expressions of the same reality. And if there's something about this object we don't like, the answer is not to operate on the object. The answer is to change the consciousness. To call Mother's consciousness to change it. Because this is only a result of the consciousness we have. If we change our consciousness, we'll change the way it looks. We'll change the form. We can, what we call illness is a consciousness that believes in a problem. When we cease to, it will cease to be there as a problem. So this is how he reconciles the subjective view and the objective view by saying there's an integral view in which both are real. The world is real. The divine one is real. They are two expressions of the same thing. Only thing is now, one of them looks more like a tumor and one of them looks more like divine bliss. Only thing is without a body, it's a bodiless thing. We have to bring them together so that that Satchitananda can manifest here, in the body, in life, and show itself as a flower. When Darcy, after his first calling her tolerable, at the second dance, he's sitting there admiring her fine eyes. Carolyn comes up and says, I guess I can guess what you're thinking now, thinking that he's mocking everybody or criticizing everybody. He says, I don't think you can guess what I'm thinking now. I was just admiring what a pair of fine eyes, how delightful it is in a woman. Well, whose eyes are you talking about? He said, Miss Elizabeth Bennet. Miss Elizabeth Bennet. I don't see anything fine about those eyes. That's not surprising, because a few weeks earlier, Darcy didn't see anything fine about them either. He thought that it was only tolerable. So, what is there in Miss... Who's right about Lizzie? Are her eyes fine or not fine? What we see in her eyes depends on our consciousness. In our case, so what we see in the world and what we discover in the world depends on the consciousness with which we experience the world. Whether the fine eyes come out or the tolerable comes out. Whether Darcy's unpardonable behavior comes out or the most magnificent behavior comes out that he's capable of at Pemberley. Depends on the consciousness with which we relate to others and the world around us. That's his view. We have to come from the sevenfold ignorance to the sevenfold knowledge, which is the subject of the book. There's no pair of tinted glasses. It's not through a microscope or a telescope or a colored glass. We have to come out of the ignorance. Each shade of the ignorance that we come out of will reveal more of the beauty in life and the joy in life. Where previously we saw ugliness or thought it was tolerable or painful or horrible and unbearable. That's why Sri Aurobindo came to see the divine even in the criminal, in the jailer. He said he worships the feet of the criminal and the harlot. It's not a poem. He sees the divinity in everything around him because he has moved out of those seven stages of the ignorance. And you know the answer because everything we've been discussing and everything Appa's been writing is the method for that. So he says, come out of the sevenfold ignorance into the sevenfold knowledge. What is the sevenfold knowledge? What is the real reality that we should know? He started by telling us we have an original ignorance. Correspondingly, we should know that the real reality, I don't mean somewhere off in nowhere's land that we'll never get to. Here, now, everywhere, all the time. The real reality is everything is the absolute. Everything is Brahman. And what is that Brahman? It's an infinite, eternal, omnipotent, omniscient bliss. It's a being that has become everything, that enjoys everything at every moment, that can become and is becoming anything and everything it wants to become, and is becoming it in us, in each of us, in the world around us, and is not limited to any of the things in which it's becoming. It's enjoying beyond that also. That is the reality. And if we're seeing anything else, it's only because of our ignorance. This is divine life in the sense the divine is already here. The divine is hidden, meaning it's not hidden from itself. Brahman is not hidden from itself. We don't know we are Brahman. We are not seeing the reality because we're ignorant. Rather, Brahman in us wants to come out and act and be conscious in each of us, and life will be divine and it, when it does that. But we must know this is the truth. If the doctor says, well, you had a life-threatening disease, but now you're cured, first thing I say, is it really true? Really? Oh, that's reassuring. Are you sure? I better ask some other doctors. I want to be sure. The truth is, the real truth, he tells us in this book, fundamentally, disease is impossible for the soul. For this life is divine. Disease is possible for the way we're living in our consciousness now. But the fundamental truth is, there is no such thing as disease. There's no such thing as evil. There's no such thing as death. Because you're immortal. Real death for your being doesn't exist. Mother writes about it, speaks about it. She says becoming more and more difficult to tell the difference between life and death because she sees, she talks about a sadhak dies and she takes the consciousness and puts it in a new baby. And even when it's not in a new baby, it's still there. All our conceptions are misconceptions looking at things from the outside in the ignorance. Fundamentally, everything's gold. Now some of it's taking a form where it doesn't look very gold. So we need to discover the gold that's inside everything. That is, we need to come out of the ignorance. When we discover the real nature of the Absolute, it's not in a vacant, far-off planet. It is here now in everything and in everybody, including the people who are giving us the most trouble all the time, and they are divine for our life. We have no a fundamental truth of the, we lose the original ignorance. We must also know the divine infinite self that's outside the universe, the transcendent, that has become the universe. that whatever we do in the universe, it's there, like Jane Austen writing her stories, exists, and that is the truth of our being. That is our self. When somebody asks you who you are that. The truth of yourself is an infinite eternal being. And it happens to be, there's only one of us. It's not a question of it's you're real and I'm not real. There's only one self, and it's all of us. Who is the author of the story? Is it Elizabeth or Darcy or Jane? There's only one author. We are all selves of that self. When we know that, we have overcome the cosmic ignorance. We know there's something beyond the cosmos that is the divine, and that is us. That's why Sri Aurobindo says, why do you want to worship God? You can become God, meaning you are already. That's the truth of your being. You just have to discover it. Elizabeth decides she wants to become an author. If her aspiration in Pride and Prejudice, oh, I wish I could write a book. You're already the author. You're the author of the whole story. You're the author of everything. You just don't know it. We have to know that we are not separate beings. We have to come out of the egoistic ignorance and know all of us are expressions of one being. We live in each other. We live through each other. We can only exist by each other. And everybody we know is a gift. For us to discover the truth of our being, we have to come out of the ego and live in a cosmic consciousness in which we know our oneness with everybody else. We have to come out of the psychological ignorance and know we are not the surface being. We are not this surface personality, this surface ego, this mind, vital and physical. We're certainly not the body. And when we try to find a bride or a groom for our children, and we go and we look and ask, what is his education, or how much money does she have as dowry, or what's her birth, or what's her family, we're treating everybody around us as if they're physical things. We're just like the materialist, like the scientist. We're treating ourselves when we describe, oh, my daughter is very eligible, she's very fair, she has this education, we have so much of a dowry for her, you know, as if we're selling a cow or something like that. We're all materialists. The truth of being is not there. The true reality of our being is something else. We have to discover not what's the surface, how intelligent, how many sorries or anything else. The truth of us is something else. We are an immortal being. We have a spiritual individuality called the psychic. When we discover that psychic, we will also know we're already immortal. Whether the body is immortal, whether the body is divine or not, we are. There's no end to us. There's no death for us. Our consciousness was there before our birth, and our consciousness will be there after, in so many lives afterwards. We come out of the temporal ignorance. Then we come to the constitutional ignorance. We have to understand the key is not that my vital should get what it wants, or my body should get what it wants, or my mind should be bossing everybody else around and telling them what to do, or telling myself what to do. These are all instruments of ignorance. I should shut up my mind, and what's the idea of giving advice to other people? I shouldn't even be giving advice to myself. I should stop thinking. I should stop trying to figure things out because it's an idiot. I should silence the mind so that the mind can express the truth of the psychic. The Prime Minister's pune is not there to be giving advice and running the country. We put the Prime Minister there to do that. The prime minister of our being is the psychic. The psychic has taken birth. The psychic has taken birth as each of us to realize its own destiny. Not that I should be very popular, or I should be very rich, or I should be more intelligent than other people. These are only the instruments. Mind should be quiet and know that it's ignorant. Vital should not demand, should not assert like Lydia and Mrs. Bennett. Physical body should be just a docile instrument so that the soul can express itself at each moment so that it can come out and come to the surface. Then we come out of the constitutional ignorance. And when we do that, when we come out of all these ignorances, then at each moment, we will know exactly what's the truth. We will know exactly what to do or not to do, what is right, what is wrong. We will not only know, we will not only have the knowledge, we will have in each moment, there'll be delight. There'll be only delight. Because it's our ignorance is also the cause of our suffering and our pain. Even evil will disappear. There will be no evil in our life. It's not a question I'll have the knowledge and know how to avoid evil. When we come out of this ignorance, there will be no evil for us. We will see the truth in everything, even in Wickham when he scandalizes. There will be no pain. We will understand whatever happens is only coming to us to release greater joy in us. So this is the integral knowledge, which is the emergence of the integral reality in us. We will know and live the integral reality, not as a philosophy, not as an explanation as I'm giving it now, in our mind, in our hearts, in our bodies, in our sensations, we will feel it as the truth. What would that mean in practice? What does it mean to us practically if we come out of the ignorance, the sevenfold ignorance, into the sevenfold knowledge? You'll recognize what Appa's been telling us all along. We will know in the depths of our being that the greatest privilege and the greatest good fortune at every moment is the joy of giving. That there's nothing that can give greater joy and fulfillment and spiritual blessing to us than the opportunity to give at every moment. That will be not a philosophy for us. It will not be a discipline. Oh, giving is good. I will, instead of asking for something, I will give something. We will know this is joy. This is fulfillment. This is gold. This is richness. Oh, I missed 14 opportunities to give today. Usually at the end of the day, I think, what did I get? Oh, that person gave me this. I'm counting up the things I'm getting. I don't even see how many opportunities I've missed to give something to another people. Somebody complimented me, I feel happy. Somebody admired me, I feel happy. Oh, I missed 100 opportunities to admire other people, to think of them, to help them, to do something for them. I was only sorry why they didn't offer me some coffee or why they didn't do something for me. Oh, he's got some extra money, he could have given it to me. Or he has a friend, he could have introduced me. To completely reverse things and know that the golden opportunities at every moment for us to come to the knowledge, to come to everything we could ever want and our soul aspires for, is to reverse the egoistic movement and say at every moment, what can I give? What do I have to give each person who comes? I never understood that even as a possibility, even as an idea, until I met Mother and met Appa. One industrialist who met Appa about 40 years ago, and Appa was telling him how he can go from 3 crores to 100 crores, and then he went to 3,000 crores. He said, I've never met a man like you. Every person you meet, you're only thinking about how they can prosper. Who thinks this way? Who thinks about the prosperity of another person? That's the way we get an infinite prosperity, and money is the smallest part of it. When we have this knowledge, one of the issues that keeps up coming up is about what is free will. See, if it's all there in the astrology chart, oh, this is fixed by the chart, then it's my destiny, it's my fate. It's my karma. Do I have freedom or do I not? This constant, oh, I can't help it, I'm a prisoner of my character. Yes, my upbringing was like that. I come from this family. My family was like that. Therefore, I'm like this. There's nothing I can do about it. We are constantly wondering, can I really do this or not? Can I really believe or not? When I'm out of this ignorance, we will know.
Ready?
Yes, Ashok.
You talked about self-giving as the best thing to do. But I have my reservations. People don't have the habit of giving themselves without wanting something in return.
Exactly.
I mean, even with the devotee's relationship with mother, he gives his devotion, but he wants her to respond with her grace. Otherwise, he won't give his devotion.
Right.
And the same thing with the parents and children. Parents shower their affection on the children, hoping the children will respond back. The same thing applies between husband and wife. So how do you propose to overcome this want something in return? Unless that is removed, self-giving won't work.
Very, very true. I would put it a little differently. Unless that is removed, it's not self-giving. It's bargaining. Bargain is not self-giving. It's a trade. What Appa means by self-giving, the self-giving that will really be lead us to the integral reality, the integral knowledge, and the integral delight, is real, pure, sincere, genuine self-giving, not what the ego does. You're absolutely right. Even there, even if to begin with, the self-giving is done with a motive, and it's done with a hope of a return. Say, when Darcy went and saved Wickham and Lydia and paid to get Wickham to marry Lydia, can we say it was a pure act of self-giving? Certainly he understood that if Wickham deserts Lydia, the whole family is ruined, and he can't marry Lizzie. So we can say that there was that personal motive even then that he did this. He had the goodness, having done it, he decided that he shouldn't tell Lizzie that. To that extent, most men would have gone and sent word in advance. You see what a great thing Darcy did for your family. He had that much of self-restraint or unselfishness to say, I don't want to tell Lizzie what I've done. But that doesn't mean there wasn't that motive. Oh, at least now there's a possibility. The family is not ruined, so there's something in it for me. You know, Appa has commented many times, Darcy loved Lizzie, but Lizzie never loved Darcy. And we've often talked about, Darcy was very happy getting Lizzie. Lizzie was happy getting Pemberley. Supposing Darcy was really capable of that perfect self-giving, that for the joy of Lizzie, I want her to be happy. For the joy of Lizzie, I'm doing this. I'm not expecting or asking anything for myself. In another story, which we have mentioned sometimes, Small House at Arlington by Trollope, Appa just recently read it, and I'm just reading it, finishing it again. A girl is proposed by Lily Dale is given a proposal by this man Crosby, who she really loves him, and he's very lucky to get her. And then at the last minute, he thinks, I can marry an aristocratic girl, and my career will go up. And he gives up Lily, and goes and marries this lady, Alexandrina, and it becomes a total nightmare for him. But Lily, who really loved him, refuses to criticize him, refuses to blame him, and she won't allow anybody to talk against him. She says, I still love him, and I want him to be happy. I want him to be happy even though he's ruined my life and chosen somebody else. He should be happy because I loved him. That's a higher self-gain. So what we can only say is, if Darcy had really had that purity which you're talking about, what he got back from Lizzie would have been something even greater. Would have been Lizzie feeling about him the way he felt about her. So instead of, you're right, Ashok, I agree with you completely. It's a very important point. But in the move away from ego, instead of taking, I give with a hope of getting something back is better than just taking. If I can purify that more and more, the more I purify it, the more what I get back will be instantaneous. The reward will be in the giving. The joy I get, the fulfillment I get, it won't depend on anyone else. What does this knowledge tell us? It's what we already know, what Appa has been telling us. The outer expresses the inner. The inner and the outer are two parts of the same reality, because even the universe and the transcendent are two parts of the same reality. They're part of, we are all together. We are one life, our one world. This barrier that something is inside and outside is all just an illusion of ignorance. Whatever I think, whatever I feel, has its consequences in the world around me, instantaneously, in my life and in the world around me. And the more closely we observe, the more we'll see you can't have a good thought without it expressing in the life around us. Everything matters. That's why this yoga is a yoga of consecration. If we can take our thoughts, it's not just our acts that are important. Our thoughts and feelings are even equally or more important. Consecrating our act is easier because the thought just goes so quick. The emotions don't feel under our control. The more we can consecrate what we are, what we do, what we say, what we think, what we feel, what we sense, the more and more we'll see the life around us having mother's atmosphere, the life around us revealing sweetness and joy. That's why mother says there is no greater joy than a consecrated living, because it is to convert every human impulse into a divine impulse. It is to reveal the divine in everything and everybody who comes around us. Everybody becomes a source for awakening us, for releasing the joy, for awakening the consciousness in us, when we take everything that happens in us and offer it to Mother. Then we understand that everything that happens to us, everything that happens to us without exception, happens to awaken, to polish the surface so the gold can come to the surface, so that the mango seed or rose seed can grow into the flower, whatever. To bring out what's hidden inside, to move us from the human life to the divine life. So whenever you have a doubt, is it really possible? Is it really possible for Morris Goodman to walk after 11 months? Is it really possible for me to have, or all of us to have 100 crores? Is it really possible to cure this illness? Is it really possible to be happy, even in with these people in these circumstances? Ask yourself, what is the ultimate reality? What is the ultimate truth? It's not that, yes, life is like this, it's filled with suffering and all of that. The ultimate truth is the integral reality that everything is divine, and the more we look for that, the more we hunt for that in ourselves and in everyone else. When I want to say, oh, he's a bad person, and that's a... when I'm looking for the undivine in everybody, I will discover it everywhere. When I try to relate to the divine in everything and every person and every circumstance of my life, I will more and more see the gold coming to the surface in them and in myself. And life will be moving from the darkness and unconsciousness of ignorance to the divine life.
I'm thanking Mr. Gary specially, and I'm thanking every devotees who have attended this session, and now we are closing this session.